you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have James Perloff back on the show. James, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me back on the show. And I think if you call it Our Interesting Show, I mean, you have such great guests on. I just had Michael Joseph on recently. He lives up in my area, and I had lunch with him not that long ago. Very informed young man.
Oh, yeah. He's doing that thing on the cult Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... okay, of course, so are the author of such books as The Shadows of Power and Tornado in a Junkyard. Of course, and you wrote the script for the Free Minds film documentary Shadow Ring. Of course, your most recent book before this one was Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which is this book, 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, Solving Political, Cultural, and Spiritual Riddles, Past and Present, is a sort of a companion piece.
That's correct. You know, I wrote that book in 2013, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and it was like it meant to be an A to Z primer on the New World Order, you know, talking about the Fed, talking about the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about globalism, media control, 9/11, weather control, things like that, police state. And then I had lost my website back in 2008, and somebody contacted me through LinkedIn when my book came out and said, would you like to build a new website? And I said, absolutely. And so I got a nice new WordPress site, and I've regularly updated that with posts that expand on Truth as a Lonely Warrior and supplement the information and have stuff that was not even in there. And I finally thought that, you know, the way that the people are being censored off the internet these days, it'd probably be a good idea to put some of these more significant articles into hard copy into a paperback. And so I chose the chapters that are in this new book, which is called 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, were chosen basically on three criteria. One was significance. I've been writing on Pearl Harbor since 1986, when I wrote a cover story for The New American. I did another one in 2001, and there's been even more information since then. And I consider that a significant piece. Also, I chose articles based on their uniqueness. Like the one on the Hindenburg does not appear anywhere else in any other book or anywhere on the internet. It's unique. It was buried in the intelligence files of Hilaire de Berryer, and I recovered it from there. And the other criterion I used was response that my readers had to articles like the one on what's going on in Syria. It's an interview with a Syrian Christian. That had 6,000 Facebook shares in the first week or two. It was a tremendous response, and so I felt that based on receptivity of people, that was another criterion. So those three criterion kind of helped me select the articles that went into this new book, 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw.
Okay, so perhaps we'll pick out a few here to discuss. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Let's Spanish-American War, a trial run for interventionism. Was this America's sort of original sin in imperialism?
In a sense, it was. It was our first interventionist war. You know, up until the Spanish-American War, Americans had always been taught and understood that the purpose of our military was to defend America. And this was the first war where our troops went overseas to fight for somebody else's freedom and democracy, which is what they've been doing ever since. And it kind of changed that entire paradigm. There are actually a lot of motives for this war. It really was not about freedom and democracy any more than the modern Middle East wars are. But, I gave a PowerPoint talk recently publicly. It's now, you can see it on the welcome page of my website. It's a whole history of false flags and deceptions that have led us into war. The title of the talk was War and Deception.
Is this a PowerPoint you did? Or new?
Yes, it's. Okay. I did it at Watertown Mass Public Library, April 27th.
Oh, okay, very recent. Okay, yeah. I'll have to check that out. Okay.
Yeah, and it ran for, including the Q&A afterwards, it actually ran a little over 2 hours. We had an edited version on my website that runs a little under 2 hours. But I started out with the Spanish-American War, and I told the audience, I know that it may sound boring to talk about something that happened over 100 years ago. We're talking about 1898. But it's absolutely amazing, Tim, that the Spanish-American War had all the elements of wars we see today. Not only was it fought for somebody else's quote-unquote freedom and democracy, you had a false flag and the sinking of the Maine. You had bankers controlling the White House because President McKinley, the president at that time, was basically owned by the Rockefellers. And you also had fake atrocity propaganda. You'll remember we got into the 91 Gulf War largely on the basis of testimony about incubator baby deaths that never happened. Well, the same thing was going on in the Spanish-American War, when the Yellow Press, which was leading the charge there, was William Randolph Hearst. And he was saying the war, just to set the context, the war was basically over Cuba, which at that time was a Spanish colony. And the oligarchs here in America wanted to get Spain out of there. They wanted to take over Cuba. And so they had to create fake pretexts. And one of them was these fake atrocity stories that Hearst was printing up about how the Spaniards were roasting priests in Cuba, and they were throwing them to the sharks, and I'm reading some headlines: butchered 300 Cuban women, defenseless prisoners shot down by Spanish soldiers. That's a headline from the New York Journal, which is Hearst newspaper, December 1896. Here's another headline: raided a hospital, more than 40 sick and wounded Cubans butchered. You know, that's all fake. I mean, there wasn't even a hospital in the area that the newspaper was describing. You know, this is all made up to get Americans ramped up for war. And then what happened was William Randolph Hearst paid bribes to have the correspondence of the Spanish ambassador to America stolen. His name was Enrique Depuy de Lome. And in one of these letters, he was critical of President McKinley. He said he was a low politician who catered to the jingoes of his party. And Hearst reprinted that under the headline, "The Worst Insult to America in Its History." Very inflammatory. And then 2 days later, the Maine blew up, and that was kind of it. And then we went to war with a battle cry, "Remember the Maine and to hell with Spain." But it was all fake.
History is full of coincidences, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. incredible.
Yeah, that's luckily we've grown past that. We can't be manipulated by media anymore.
Oh, the entire American public is completely wised up to atrocity stories, false flags, war deceptions. I mean, if the American establishment gets to fight an overseas war today, I mean, there's just hundreds of thousands of protesters take to the street and they back down, you know. So I'm so glad that America's completely awake.
It's just amazing how savage, you know, these other countries are on this, you know, the Catholic Spaniards are so savage. The same with the Germans who are Lutheran and Catholic. And they're just so savage. It's incredible.
Well, you know, I can't show it on a radio show, but what I did in the PowerPoint presentation, there was this picture of Spain, a propaganda picture created in the press, and it was labeled Spain. And the creature was half man and half ape. And he's got his bloodied hands on the grave of the sailors on the Maine. And just under his foot, he's trampling the American flag as if to challenge us to a war, which is, you know, Spain was trying to. Spain was desperately trying to avoid a war with America because, you know, to fight in Cuba, they would have to come 4,000 miles. But Cuba's only about 100 miles off our coast. And also their navy was basically a wooden navy, whereas we had a navy that was increasingly a steel navy and our guns had much better firepower. And that was proven by the two naval battles that took place during the Spanish-American War of 1898. We know we fought their Pacific Squadron and we destroyed it in the Battle of Manila Bay. And then in the Battle of Santiago, Cuba, we destroyed their Caribbean squadron, and we didn't lose a single ship. In fact, we only had one casualty in each battle, and one of those casualties was actually from a heart attack, not from shrapnel or fire from the Spanish ships. So the Spain was trying to avoid a war desperately, and the last thing they would have done would have been to sink the Maine in an effort to goad the tiger into a war. That's not what they wanted at all. It was the American oligarchs that wanted the war.
Yeah, yeah. I think the engagement in the Philippines actually occurred before the official declaration of war, if I have that right.
Well, I know that before war began, Teddy Roosevelt, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, ordered the ships there. And I know, I think actually, Tim, the sequence is that when we attacked the fleet in Manila, Spain had already surrendered.
Okay.
They had already surrendered, so it was, you know, a pointless attack. But of course, as you know, as spoils of war, we took over the Philippines. We took all of Spain's colonies: Guam, Puerto Rico. That's how we got Puerto Rico. And one of the great ironies was that American soldiers were being told, "You're going down to Cuba to fight against colonialism." Yet we ourselves became a colonial power by taking over Spain's colonies. But in the manner of Orwell's Newspeak, instead of calling them colonies, we simply called them possessions. We said Puerto Rico is an American possession, but, you know, that was just semantics.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe Teddy Roosevelt was then Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah, it's interesting how the assistants are often more important than the guys who are actually at the top, who are more of the figureheads. You know, that's true of the Federal Reserve. You know, you might recall Paul Warburg, who masterminded the Federal Reserve, was not the original chairman of the Federal Reserve. He was the assistant chairman. So he was really running things, but they had a figurehead in front. And people would think the same thing about Bush and Cheney, that Cheney really ran the White House, and it just looked like Bush was the man in charge. But that's kind of typical. Yeah. That was true during the Spanish-American War. Teddy Roosevelt, of course, then became head of the Rough Riders. And it's interesting how he exploited his fame, because by November of 1898, with the war over, he became governor of New York. And by 1901, he was the president of the United States.
Yeah, because, of course, McKinley was assassinated.
Yes, McKinley was assassinated. I don't know if that was really done in the manner that was said, you know, at the World's Fair exposition anarchist who was oversold on propaganda, or if the establishment just felt that Teddy Roosevelt would make a better replacement for him. McKinley seemed like he was providing very adequate service, so I don't really see the Rockefeller Morgan Rothschild and just necessarily wanting to take him out, but that is how Teddy Roosevelt became president, was through that assassination.
Yeah, the assassin himself has a strange background. They had no means of income, but he had money, and he also had ties to Emma Goldman and some anarchists. And Leon Czolgosz, I think, was his name.
Right, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I think the day that the U.S. fleet attacked the Spanish fleet out in the Philippines, the assistant, I think, the Secretary of the Navy, was out. He wasn't feeling well, had gout or something, and he gave instructions to Roosevelt to not to do anything.
So. And Roosevelt defied him, and the Secretary of the Navy, his name was Long, later said of Teddy Roosevelt, that the very devil seemed to possess him that day.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that, I mean, that war, I mean, it is, that's America's, you know, America became a kind of a blue water empire without the Philippines. It got possessions in Asia, and this was America's kind of foot in the door in China with the other European powers. And of course, there was her, America's possessions in the Pacific, Hawaii had been seized a few years before. But the Philippines, of course, was a point of contention between America and the Japanese Empire in 1941. And it was all those possessions that were attacked by the Japanese Empire in 1941. So it set the stage for the Pacific War.
That's an interesting point. All of those places we took over, by the way, including Hawaii, were big sugar producers. And, you know, they were they called sugar white gold, just as the Rockefellers would call oil black gold. At that time, sugar was considered a very, very valued commodity. And Cuba was actually the world's largest sugar producer, but the Philippines were big sugar producers, and so was Puerto Rico. So, and National City Bank, which the Rockefellers controlled just as strong as almost as much as they controlled the White House at that time, National City Bank took over the Cuban sugar industry after the war. So, you know, there was a lot at play. There were actually other reasons too. I personally believe that the destruction of Catholic Spain has been a long time objective of the worldwide oligarchy, and I think this is one of about six elements in the Spanish-American War as well. But another was bringing about the Anglo-American alliance. You know, prior to the Spanish-American War, most Americans still look with great resentment on Great Britain, rightly or wrongly, remembering the colonial times and our wars of that time. But during the Spanish-American War, the only country in Europe that supported America was Britain. In fact, when the regent of Spain, I think it was Queen Cristina, appealed to the other countries of Europe to appeal to support Spain, the plan was leaked to America by the British. And when an American officer scouted out Puerto Rico before we attacked, he went in and he left a British ship in a British uniform. And during the Battle of Manila, the British fleet stood between our fleet attacking Spain and the German fleet. Now, whether or not they were just there sightseeing, or whether or not they were trying to make sure the Germans didn't interfere, that's never been absolutely clear. But it is clear that in 1898, as the war was in progress, the Anglo-American League was founded, and that became the Pilgrim Society. And that was the beginning of what Carol Quigley called the Anglo-American establishment. The Pilgrim Society then, which is still in existence today, became sort of a mother of the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations. So that was the beginning of the Anglo-American interventionist establishment. So a lot was happening in the Spanish-American War behind the scenes that you don't really gather if you only look at it superficially.
Yeah, this is the time of the Great Rapprochement, as it's called. And throughout the 19th century, there's a series of revolutions throughout Latin America against the Spanish Empire. You know, Simon Bolivar, the Bolivarian revolutions. And of course, you had the what was going on in Mexico, and these all had Freemasonic support. And it's interesting to note that a lot of these revolutions were never popular. They had military support, and this, of course, the support ties back to a lot of Freemasonic organizations in America and also Great Britain. And this was designed to undermine the Catholic Empire throughout Latin America. And we saw that, of course, in the early 20th century in Mexico, you know, with Huerta and Carranza and Diaz, how they passed this harsh anti-Catholic legislation, where it was illegal for priests to wear their collars in public, church property was stolen. And this had support, largely, for the most of the time, had support of the U.S. government. It was anti-Catholic, of course, but also because of the U.S., the Rockefellers, the Hearsts, and the Morgan House all had claims on Mexican oil and other resources, other raw materials.
Absolutely. And thanks. I always appreciate those insights. It becomes increasingly clearer to me, Tim, that the destruction of the Catholic Church, as I was sort of broaching before, has been a long-term objective of the international establishment. Catholicism representing the most ancient and in its original form, the truest form of Christianity that the West had seen, not to deny that legitimate corruptions were detected by Martin Luther, but that resulted in the splintering of Christianity, which is exactly what the devil wanted, divide and conquer. And then each Protestant denomination went its own way. And they all, you know, churches I've attended, you know, I'm Orthodox now, but I was attending evangelical churches for 30 years. And I can tell you that most of the churches I went to, if you looked at the history, in most cases, they were a spinoff of a spinoff of a spinoff of a spinoff of Martin Luther, basically. And so that, you know, whatever, however you worship is what the latest thing that the elder board has decided, which is probably half dominated by Freemasons.
And America, when it was founded, you could say sort of largely sort of Enlightenment Freemasonic project, definitely a Protestant project. But into the 19th century, when you had the influx of Germans and Irish immigrants into the country in the middle half of the 19th century because of the troubles in Germany and in Ireland, but also America's own imperial ambition led to this because they took off a huge chunk of the Spanish Empire, which was wholly Catholic. And right. So at that point, it's same with this also occurred with the Louisiana Purchase earlier in 19th century when the Louisiana Purchase occurred. That was a huge Catholic area, Spanish and French influence. Mm. And so it was at this point that you really had this conflict that was later developed in America because you had huge Catholic influence and also a huge Catholic population, which was largely, again, I think there is a conflict both theologically and philosophically with America's Freemasonic founding principles, you know, which had to be brought under control, which we saw in the 20th century, sort of the, sort of this cowing or weakening of the church, putting the church at the service of the state as opposed to the church opposing the state.
Yeah, no question that the Catholic Church today has been degraded by through infiltration. But you know, I always learned so much from you about history, Tim. Whenever on your show, and things always make more sense to me when I leave your show. But I feel it is important to understand that when you read the history books, quite often one misses the, even in the alt media, you often miss the spiritual undercurrent that is taking place. The attacks on Syria, sure, it's about oil, it's about greater Israel, but I think it's also partly due to the fact that Syria was actually one of the original points where Christianity was established. In fact, according to the book of Acts, the Christians were first called Christians in Antioch, and the church there goes back a long time. And I think that is part of the hatred for Syria, is along with all the other factors, is the spiritual element. And if we get into my chapter on Nagasaki, of course, there's Nagasaki, which we atom bombed, was called the Japanese Vatican. There were 50,000 Christians in that city. And David Dionisi, who I know, I'm sure you've had him on your program. Is that correct, David
Dionisi? No, I have not.
Oh,
sorry. I saw the book. It was like real expensive on Amazon.
They're probably, that's probably by design. Mm-hmm. Dionisi is a Catholic, and he's written quite insightfully on that. And he's also written on 9/11, and he points out the spiritual dimension that comes with these the things like the bombing of Dresden, the atomic bombs in Japan, and 9/11 itself, with everyone being basically incinerated or vaporized inside the buildings. We could even get into the Hindenburg on this, but basically what he points out is that Satanists believe that when they and this goes back to the child's satanic ritual sacrifices before Moloch, you know, in Canaanite times, that they think that the Satanists think they draw power from the death of the victim. And when you do it on a massive scale, they think that the power is even greater. But the point being that to all these events, in addition to the geopolitics, there is a spiritual element taking place as well that it serves us well to be cognizant of.
Yeah, definitely. Is he available for interviews and all that?
Oh, I'm sure he must be. I think I've been in Eric Gajewski's show, Tradcat Night, and I think he had him on. My mistake, I thought you had told me he'd been on your show before. So somebody certainly told me they had him on as a guest before. I think he'd be delighted to come on, and I think you guys would probably have quite a bit in common.
Yeah, it seems like an interesting angle on these events because there's so many different dimensions and angles to these things. Mm-hmm. The one can explore. I have to look into that. Okay, moving along here, you have, of course, that's World War One, of course, you have Lusitania, how that ship was set up to be sunk.
Right, and that was a major false flag, and I kind of feel that they were using their success with the Maine in this incident. One of the great advantages of using a ship as a false flag is that it goes to the bottom of the ocean, and you can't really examine it to find out what really happened. You know, so the evidence is pretty much buried, and so people just have to rely on media reports. And what happened with Lusitania was, you know, the oligarchs wanted to get us into the First World War, and Winston Churchill was the head of the British Admiralty. It's interesting that the Assistant Secretary of the Navy at that point was Teddy Roosevelt's cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, mm-hmm. who, just like Teddy, then became governor of New York and then president of the United States. Very interesting. And both he and Churchill became heads of state at the same time as World War II approached. But at the time of the Lusitania, the World War I had broken out in 1914 with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and Britain in 1915 was at war with Germany, but the powers that be wanted America into the war, which was ridiculous. We had no reason to be in the war. So, you know, originally the Germans, when they would sink a commercial vessel, they would first surface, the sub would surface, and they would allow the all the crew or passengers disembark on lifeboats. And you can see even footage of this, actual footage on YouTube of this. But what happened was that Churchill decided to change the rules, and he ordered that merchantmen must be armed with cannons, and they must use their cannons or ram subs if they surfaced. And so the subs, several of them were sunk in this manner. So finally the Germans said, enough is enough. We, you know, we can't do that. That's exactly what Churchill wanted, because he hoped that through the defective vision of a periscope, a German sub would mistake an American ship for British and sink it. Well, that never happened. The Germans were scrupulous. They did not want America coming into the war. So Churchill went to Plan B, and Plan B was, we'll have the Germans sink in a British ship with Americans on board. That was the Lusitania, sunk on May the 7th, 1915. 1,200 passengers died. There were about 700 rescued, but 128 Americans died. And that became the cause that Woodrow Wilson constantly used to push America towards its declaration of war. And the Germans, of course, tried everything to prevent it. But the reason they sank the Lusitania, contrary to the propaganda which said they did it to kill innocent women and children, let me tell you what was on in the cargo hold of the Lusitania, Tim. It was 173 tons of Remington rifle cartridges, 50 tons of shrapnel shells. Now, the British claimed the shrapnel shells were empty, but divers went down to the wreck and discovered they were full of shrapnel. Also, 46 tons of aluminum hydroxide, which was a military explosive used by the British, 18 cases of mercury fulminate, another powerful military explosive, and we don't know the exact number of tons of gun cotton, but there was a huge number of tons of gun cotton, which the British used in their sea mines. Now, it didn't show up in the ship's manifest because the British disguised it on their manifest. But we know that they had ordered it and it was seen being loaded onto the Lusitania. And this is actually one of several trips that the Lusitania had made, taking munitions from America to Britain to fight against the Germans. And the Germans had to put a stop to it because these munitions were being used to kill the soldiers on the front. And of course, the British were using women and children as the excuse that the ship couldn't be torpedoed. The Germans did everything they could to prevent the American passengers from getting on board. They even, as you probably know, took out ads in all the major American newspapers right next to the Cunard. Cunard was the owner of Lusitania, next to the Cunard's shipping notices telling Americans not to board the ship, that there was a state of war between America and Britain, and that any Americans who boarded these ships were doing so at their own risk. In fact, the Lusitania was classified in Jane's fighting ships as an auxiliary cruiser, which she was. She was outfitted to carry cannon, and there's dispute as to whether she actually had cannon. There is testimony that she had cannon on her lower deck where the passengers were never allowed to go. There's dispute about it, but there's no question that she was a legitimate target for the Germans. But the Americans were not told that, although Senator Bob La Follette gave a speech revealing that the Lusitania was carrying millions of rounds of munitions and explosives, which was in violation of American law for a passenger to sail on a ship that had munitions on it. And the oligarchs tried to have him impeached from the American Congress, or I guess expelled would be the correct word. But then former Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan came forward and corroborated everything that La Follette had said, which stopped those proceedings. But that was going on. Not a false flag in that the Germans didn't do it, but it was a false flag in that there was tremendous deception involved. It was a legitimate target, and it was not done to kill innocent women and children, as was claimed in all the propaganda that followed.
Yeah, and William Jennings Bryan, I guess, he also eventually resigned as Secretary of State over the pro-war policies of the neutral Wilson administration.
That's correct. He could not tolerate Wilson's pro-war policies any longer. He was asked to sign a statement to the Germans, claiming they were mistaken about the Lusitania. He knew it was false because director of customs in New York City had verified to the administration that he said that almost everything on board the Lusitania was contraband. And William Jennings Bryan was quite aware of it. He would not sign the statement that to the Germans that Wilson wanted him to sign, and he finally just resigned in disgust. I have to say that William Jennings Bryan was a very good man, and if people have read my book Tornado in a Junkyard, I have a full chapter on there. And
yeah,
one of the last events of his life, which was the Scopes trial, where he fought in defense of the Bible and against Darwin's theory of evolution. He died about 5 days after that trial took place, but it was his last act. And I have to say that he was one of our statesmen who was truly honorable.
And he did win that case.
Well, technically he did, but yeah, in the media he lost it because Clarence Darrow, the attorney for the main attorney for the prosecution, was put him on the witness stand to defend the Bible, and Darrow had all these trick questions prepared, and because he was on the witness stand, he could not ask Darrow any questions about evolution, which is what he wanted to do. And Darrow tricked Bryan into thinking that they would trade places, and that the following day Darrow would go on the witness stand and Bryan would be allowed to question him about evolution. But instead of letting that happen, having won a sort of a tactical victory over Bryan on the witness stand and his question about the Bible, again, as a witness, he could Bryan himself could not ask any questions. Darrow simply ended the case by declaring that his client John Scopes was guilty of violating the Tennessee law, and he said we have no further statements to make. But that's all he wanted to do. The show was never about whether Scopes was innocent or guilty. It was all about creating a showcase for Darwin's theory of evolution and attacking the Bible.
Yeah, most people's understanding of that case is in the play or the movie Inherit the Wind, I guess.
Yes, and what I did in that chapter was I took the script for Inherit the Wind and compared it to the trial transcript and showed there were basically 180 degrees opposite. I mean, they've got in the movie they have William Jennings Bryan denouncing science, but in the actual trial, he's called science invincible. And he praised science. In fact, he was a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He was not anti-science at all, as he appears to be in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Back to the war, of course, with the Lusitania, it sunk very fast, I think under 20 minutes, 15 minutes perhaps.
And 18, exactly. 18. There were two explosions, a small one and a large one. And, of course, the small one was the torpedo hitting.
Yeah.
And, those World War I torpedoes were quite small compared to World War II. It normally would have taken many torpedoes to sink the Lusitania. In fact, it had a sister ship called the Mauritania, and it was hit by 12 torpedoes that didn't sink. It took the munitions detonating to take the ship down.
Yeah, and it was munitions detonating. For years, it was reported for decades that the German submarine had fired a second torpedo. But it turns out that, in fact, there's an old World War One era cartoon out there. It's a silent, of course, but it has a cartoon of the German sub firing a second torpedo to sink the ship.
Yes, that's one of the things they claimed. Actually, when it encountered the Lusitania, the U-20, that sub had only two torpedoes left. It fired one of the Lusitania, and then headed back for Germany. It kept one torpedo, which it knew it would need. The captain knew he would need that just in case for defense on the way home.
And so I guess, you know, the idea was you sink the boat, you cause a pretext, create a pretext for America's entry into the war. And of course, America's neutrality, even at that point, was largely nominal because of the intrigues within the Roosevelt administration. The fact that, you know, with the British, you know, in the context here is also the British, illegal British blockade, which they were mining neutral waters to starve Germany. So that's the context of Germany's submarine warfare, you know. So
that's right. The reason they were using U-boats to attack commercial shipping was the best answer they had to Britain completely blockading the North Sea with the Royal Navy and mining it so that no neutral ships could pass food to or other supplies to Germany, which is one reason why hundreds of thousands of Germans died of starvation during that war. I should also just mention, as long as we're on the Lusitania, that that the ship was apparently deliberately sent to its destruction. We have a lot of quotes that support that. We have, for example, our ambassador to Britain, Walter Hines Page. This guy is interesting. You know, while he was ambassador to Britain on public salary, he was getting a private salary from Cleveland Dodge, the munitions manufacturer, of $25,000 a year, which is over half a million in today's dollars. So, you know, he was basically getting bribed by the munitions industry. But 5 days before the Lusitania sank, on May the 2nd, 1915, he wrote a letter to his son, and he said in this letter, quote, "If a British liner full of American passengers be blown up, what will Uncle Sam do? That's what's going to happen," end quote. And as you know, Woodrow Wilson had a controller from Wall Street named Edward Mandel House, who lived right in the White House. And when the Lusitania went down, he was in Britain, of course. And on the day the Lusitania was sunk, he met that morning with the British Foreign Minister, Edward Grey. And here's what's in his official biography, you know, the papers of Colonel House. He wrote, quote, "We fell to talking, strangely enough, of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner." I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. We said to Grey, he said, "We quote, we spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk. And I told him if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep America, which would in itself probably carry us into the war," end quote. And the quote I was starting to give you was that House and Foreign Minister Edward Grey that same morning, that same day, went to Buckingham Palace and saw King George V. And House wrote of that encounter, quote, "We felt to talking, strangely enough, of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner. He," meaning the king, "said, suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board," end quote. And about 2 hours later, the Lusitania was sunk. I mean, these people knew it was coming because Britain had cracked Germany's naval codes. They were intercepting messages between Germany and her U-boat fleet. And the day before the Lusitania was sunk, the U-20 had sunk two steamers right in that area. They sent the Lusitania right into that area. And usually there would be destroyers accompanying her. But on that particular day, no destroyers were sent out, even though there were four destroyers lying idle in the nearby port of Milford Haven. And to give you a final quote on the Lusitania, let me quote Patrick Beasley, who was considered the leading authority on the history of British naval intelligence, in which he was long an officer. Speaking of the Lusitania, he said, quote, "Nothing, absolutely nothing was done to ensure the liner's safe arrival. I'm reluctantly driven to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy deliberately to put the Lusitania at risk in the hopes that even an abortive attack on her would bring the United States into the war. Such a conspiracy could not have been put into effect without Winston Churchill's express permission and approval," end quote. Patrick Beasley in his book, Room 40.
And even with the sinking of Lusitania, it took another 2 years almost to get the America into the war officially. I think war is declared April 4th, 1917 by the Congress at the request of Woodrow Wilson. Despite war fever, there's a lot of opposition to it, a lot of skepticism, so much so that laws had to be passed to more or less suspend the Bill of Rights, suspend the Constitution, like the Sedition Act, which pretty much made free speech illegal in the country. People wore sent to prison for citing things like the Bill of Rights.
That's right. In fact, they passed the Espionage Act in 1917 and the Sedition Act in 1918. And one of the ironies is that no German spy, nobody spying for Germany, was ever prosecuted under those acts, but hundreds of Americans went to prison for opposing the war, which shows you what those laws were really about.
Yeah, it wasn't the Kaiser dragging you off to jail. Right. It was the president's men, you know, the I guess, organizations that were created, you know, like the what were they called? These private organizations were go out and harass people for not buying bonds or not signing up and these things. So.
Yes, you could go to prison for 20 years just for opposing the sale of war bonds. But the interesting thing, Tim, is that after the war, the Graham Committee of Congress conducted an investigation into war profiteering, mm-hmm. and they produced a 21-volume report that took 3 years to develop, and it showed that Bernard Baruch and his fellow bankers and industrialists had looted the American taxpayers out of $6 billion worth of munitions that were never manufactured or sent to the front, and said they folded that money into their own companies. And indictments were handed down, but they were all quashed. Not one banker went to prison. And today, there's not even an entry in Wikipedia for the Graham Committee. I like to say it's flushed down one of Orwell's memory holes. But mm-hmm. it's absolutely true that these people who were trying to oppose this corruption would be sent to jail for up to 20 years for saying that you couldn't, you know, sell bonds or manufacture these things. In point of fact, they were looting America at the time. In fact, here's one of the ironies is that there were all these posters up about buy war bonds, you know, help our soldiers, mm-hmm. help these poor people who've been sent to the front. It's interesting that I think it was the first $400 million from the war bonds that were sold went directly to J.P. Morgan and Company to compensate him in his company for money they'd loaned to Great Britain for war munitions. So it wasn't going to the front like people thought. It wasn't supporting America, it was supporting J.P. Morgan. But isn't that the story that of war throughout the last century and a half and here in America?
Well, I think you were paid $20 a month to fight in the trenches, so you know they got their beaks wet.
Oh, yeah. they get their payback. As you probably know, too, the after they were promised bonuses, and so later mm-hmm. During the Great Depression, you had these bonus marches where veterans who marched on Washington, and then of course they were tear gassed and repelled by the American military for demanding what they'd been promised by Congress for being mm-hmm. veterans of the war.
You have an interesting piece also on the Hindenburg. This is something that not many people have heard of: is the intrigues or the that went into the destruction of the Hindenburg. Was it 1937?
Yeah, May of 1937. This is a really interesting story, and the reason that I printed this and then reproduced it in my book is I found that what I believe is the truth about the Hindenburg, and it's buried in the newsletter of Hilaire de Berryer. Now, he was an old OSS man. He left the OSS when it downsized after World War II, which he said meant getting rid of the anti-communist with its ranks. But he started his own newsletter out of Monaco in 1958, and he ran it until 2001. And in that newsletter, I've read all his newsletters, he had the story of the Hindenburg. And when I looked online, I was stunned to find that nobody in alt media had ever picked up this story before. And I said, I've got to resurrect this for public knowledge because I believe it's the true story. And so the story of the Hindenburg, which was a German Zeppelin, the largest airship of its time, it had crossed the Atlantic 63 times. On its last voyage, it was docking in Lakehurst, New Jersey at night, and just suddenly it blew up. It was this massive ball of flame. Dozens of people died, and more were injured. And it was claimed, and to this very day, that the explosion was caused by static electricity. You know, just like a good old Flight 800, which exploded over the Atlantic, that was just due to a spark in the fuel tank, and not those streaks of light that dozens of witnesses saw going up to Flight 800, this was back in the mid-1990s, of course. But the Hindenburg, they've always claimed, was just static electricity. And they said, okay, airships are unsafe. And unfortunately, the airships, which were a very comfortable way to cross the Atlantic, that was all suspended after that because they said it's unsafe. with the true story that Hindenburg was told by Duberrier. And of all people, it came from Tim McAuliffe, who was the Spalding Sporting Goods representative in Boston. And that might not sound like it makes sense to people at first, but you have to understand that the man, according to McAuliffe, who masterminded the destruction of the Hindenburg was Mo Berg. Now, Mo Berg is somebody who some of your listeners have probably heard of. In the 1970s, and ever since, there have been books, and I believe a movie as well now, about Mo Berg, the catcher who was a spy, right? He was a Major League Baseball catcher. He wasn't much of a hitter. In 15 years, he had a grand total of 6 home runs. So Babe Ruth, he was not. but he was a chronic third-string catcher, and his last team was the Boston Red Sox. That's who he was playing for in 1937. And he used to hang out at Tim McAuliffe's apartment. Tim McAuliffe was, represented the Spalding Sporting Goods Company in Boston. And he provided Harvard and Bowdoin and other colleges with their sporting goods, and the Boston Red Sox with their sporting goods. And the Red Sox used to hang out at his apartment, especially Mo Berg, because, Mo Berg wanted someplace to stay in the off season to hang out with his radical friends. I've got to explain that Mo Berg, people who don't know it, was an OSS agent like Duberrier. He was a covert government agent as well as a Major League Baseball player. He was a graduate of Princeton. He could speak 7 languages, and he was a Jewish ardent Zionist. And after the war, he asked the CIA to assign him to Israel, which they declined to do, but he was an ardent Zionist. And here's the story of the Hindenburg, according to McAuliffe. On May the 1st, 1937, the Red Sox were at Yankee Stadium, and McAuliffe was in New York, and he paid a visit to the Red Sox clubhouse, and Mo Berg was talking to some other men, and suddenly things got quiet. And so McAuliffe's like, what's up? And Berg said, Tim, in a few days, you're going to hear something really awful. So McAuliffe is thinking to himself, well, the Major League trading deadline back then was coming up. He said, oh no, don't tell me the Red Sox are going to trade Jimmy Fox. And Berg said, no, but you're going to read about it in the newspapers. So a few days later, the Red Sox come back from their away trip. They're back home. And McAuliffe noticed that Berg is in a very smug, self-satisfied mood. And Berg says, come on, Tim, let's get some lunch at the Lobster Pot, which was an old Boston area restaurant. So they're at lunch. And then Berg says, so, Tim, what did you think of that thing a few days ago? And McAuliffe says, what thing? Down in Lakehurst, New Jersey. And McAuliffe says, yeah, wasn't that terrible? And then suddenly he thinks to himself, he says, wait a minute, Mo, that's not what you meant when you said something terrible is going to happen, is it? And Mo says, yeah, Tim, we've got to do something to make that maniac, meaning Adolf Hitler, attack us. And then as McAuliffe is sitting there in stunned silence, and as Berg is continuing to eat, he tells him everything that happened. He says, 4 of my men, meaning 4 of Berg's men, were down in Lakehurst. They were hiding in the bushes. It was dark. It was night. They had a rifle with a telescopic sight. But he said, you know what? The Hindenburg was so big, they didn't even need the sight, the telescopic sight. And then fired an incendiary bullet into it. Now, talking to you, Tim Kelly. Okay, we got 2 Tims here. Here's the reason I believe Tim McAuliffe's story. Number one, he was not a political person. He was just the representative of Spalding Sporting Goods. He had no reason to invent this story. He was not into politics at all. Number two, he told the story decades before it became covert knowledge that Mo Berg was indeed a covert U.S. government agent. Number three, I looked up on the internet, and this is something that Duberrier would not have known in Monaco, but you can find all this stuff on the internet very easily. Now, the Red Sox were indeed at Yankee Stadium on May the 1st, 1937. I checked that. And I was also curious about the history of incendiary bullets. And you know what the first use of incendiary bullets was, according to Wikipedia? Tim, the first basic use was by the British during World War I to bring down German Zeppelins. That was how you brought down a Zeppelin. You fired an incendiary bullet to explode that helium. So all this story, to me, has all the trademarks of the true story. Yet I found that no one else had posted it on the internet. No one else had it. Only Duberrier had it. So I figured, you know what? God bless Hilaire de Berrier, who had a lot of unique information in his intelligence newsletter. And so I reprinted his words and also turned it into a chapter of my book.
So when he was a spy, for whom was he spying?
Well, you know, he was for the OSS, he was sent on an assassination mission to Europe. So we know, although he didn't end up carrying out the assassination, we know he was quite capable of killing people, and he did work for the OSS during World War II. Now, the question is, was he working for the government before World War II, or was he on his own? This I don't know, but he did go. This is funny. In 1933, he went with a baseball all-star team, guys like Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth, an all-star team. Now, what's a third-string catcher doing on an all-star team going to Japan? Now, while he was in Japan, he took pictures of Tokyo and Japan from rooftops, which were later used in the bombing of Japan. So whether or not it was just a coincidence that he took those pictures, or whether or not he already had foreknowledge that war was coming with Japan, I don't know if he was actually doing that on assignment for the U.S. government covertly. I don't know when his actual service began. Those are one of those things that spooks don't talk about. But none of the books, to my knowledge, on Moberg have ever mentioned his connection to the Hindenburg, but I do believe that's the true story.
So I guess this is not too long after Judea had declared war on Germany.
Well, which was 1933, right? So yeah, he may have done this in connection with an organization. I'm just throwing this out. I have no confirmation. It's just benign breath or something like that. I have no idea. Or when he said my men, was he talking about covert government agents? McAuliffe was afraid to come forward initially because he afraid it was a government operation, but he wasn't sure.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been something like some group like Ergun or something.
Something in that order, because the Irgun was operating not long after that. You're right, yeah. Terrorists in the 1940s, for example, the ones who blew up the King David Hotel in 1946. So we're not talking about a very long span of time, are we?
Yeah, I mean, we have these events that we think we have an understanding of because how they're reported. But, it's pretty much acknowledged that the King David Hotel bombing was a false flag. Initially, they tried to blame Arabs for it. You have Operation Susanna, or the Levant affair, and any number of bombings that occur at Israeli embassies or establishments, whether it's a synagogue or where a bombing occurs. It's whenever we hear this, you have to be skeptical that we should just take the immediate story or the official narrative at face value. When we all know that this is a great way to gin up support or create a pretext for war or just to increase fundraising,
Well, yeah. No, it's been going on for a long time, and including 9/11 and including the attack on USS Liberty, which was done by Israel in unmarked planes. And it just seems again and again and again, going back to King David Hotel, where they went in with explosives and they were wearing Arab outfits, to blame it on the Arabs. It just seems that it's modus operandi. The MO that distinguishes a criminal. They've done it again and again.
Yeah, and this would have been, at a time when certain elements or interests within the United States, Great Britain, and also the Jewish diaspora would want to create a pretext for war. It's war with Germany. It's interesting that you write that Germany knew of this, but they decided to cover it up as well. I guess discretion being the better part of valor. Isn't worth starting a war over, but they apparently, the German government knew at the time there was likely a sabotage.
Correct. They knew that this was not just static electricity. They knew that it was an attempt to arouse passions for war, but they wanted no part of a war with America because they remembered World War I and how our entering that war had lost that war for them. And so they wanted no part of any war with America. And that's why when we had our destroyers during 1941, before World War II officially began for America, we were actually depth charging their U-boats and they wouldn't fight back for the most part, for the simple reason they did not want to sink an American ship. They didn't want another Lusitania. They did not want any part of the Hindenburg inflaming passions on either side of the Atlantic and starting a war between America and Germany. They wanted nothing to do with it.
You also go through Pearl Harbor, the Korean War. Mm. Well, I think people are generally familiar with Pearl Harbor. Do you want to touch anything on that, or?
Well, as I may have mentioned, I've written on Pearl Harbor since 1986.
Mm-hmm.
I did mention that at the top. Pearl Harbor, there, we won't go into it in great detail. I've done a number of shows on it. People can read the chapter. And you and I did a show on World War II, where I'm pretty sure we touched on the main elements. But basically, the things to know about Pearl Harbor, which, of course, was the event that brought us into World War II when Japanese planes launched from aircraft carriers, attacked the American fleet, is number one, we provoked the attack by strangling Japan with a economic boycott in conjunction with the Dutch and the British. And they were earnestly trying to end that boycott, and we gave them terms that were impossible for them to possibly accept. In fact, let me give one quote from the British historian Russell Grenfell, former captain of the Royal Navy, just so people won't think that, you know, I'm just making this up or something. He said, quote, "No reasonably informed person can now believe that Japan made a villainous, unexpected attack on the United States. An attack was not only fully expected, but was actually desired. It is beyond doubt that President Roosevelt wanted to get his country into war, but for political reasons was most anxious to ensure that the first act of hostility came from the other side, for which reason he caused increasing pressure to be put on the Japanese to a point that no self-respecting nation could endure without resort to arms. Japan was meant by the American president to attack the United States," end quote, Russell Grenfell. Many other quotes we could go into. The attack was provoked, Tim. Also, a question people need to ask is, why was the fleet in Pearl Harbor in the first place? You know, our fleet commander, J.O. Wilson, I'm sorry, thinking of a Harvard professor, J.O. Richardson, flew to Washington in a rage when he heard that Roosevelt had ordered that the fleet should stay permanently in Hawaii, because normally it was berthed around San Diego on the West Coast, and he gave the president so many great reasons to keep the fleet on the West Coast. You know, as Hawaii would be vulnerable to a surprise attack from 360 degrees because it's the middle of the ocean. It'd be very hard to resupply the fleet over 2,000 miles of Pacific. Our ships would be boxed together like sardines, making them perfect targets for bombers. It would cut off the entire Pacific fleet from their families. You know, great, so great reasons. And Roosevelt could only give one reason for putting the fleet in Pearl Harbor. He said it will deter Japanese aggression, which was resoundingly disproven on December the 7th, 1941. But nonetheless, Roosevelt fired J.O. Richardson right after this, or well, shortly after this meeting, for protesting the move to Pearl Harbor. The third thing to know is that we had complete foreknowledge of the attack, and there were three basic means that Roosevelt and his compatriots in Washington had foreknowledge of the attack. Number one was we cracked Japan's diplomatic code called the Purple Code, and we had our own machines spitting out transcripts with the result that we actually read their declaration of war the day before they handed it to us, but we didn't warn Pearl Harbor. Also, we knew about the attack from personal warnings from J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, from Joseph Gru, our ambassador to Japan, and many other sources, military sources. And thirdly, we had also cracked Japan's naval codes, which came to public knowledge with the publication of Robert Stinnett's book in the year 2000 on the history it's called Day of Deceit. So we provoked the attack, we set up the attack by putting the fleet in Pearl Harbor, and we knew about the attack.
Yeah, and it's interesting to point out just the decisions taken by the Roosevelt administration in the summer of 1941 are generally considered preludes to war anyway, when you seize assets and you organize an international trade embargo on mm-hmm. an island nation, you know, without even willing to negotiate terms that government can accept. I mean, clearly, it's a typical situation. The U.S. has done this throughout the years, is where they'll negotiate, the government that they're negotiating with will make some concessions, then they'll up the ante. So they can never come to any peaceful arrangement,
right?
Because you want the. They did the same thing with Milosevic in Serbia in the 1990s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You push people to the point where, you know, like we mentioned the Spanish-America War. We did the same thing with the Spanish. You know, the Spanish accepted every demand from America. And finally, the McKinley administration demanded that Spain evacuate Cuba, right? Well, Spain had ruled Cuba since 1511. And everybody in Spain thought that Cuba was part of Spain, just like we consider Hawaii part of America today, right? And the Spanish knew that if they accepted the ultimatum to leave Cuba, they'd have a revolution at home. So they said, well, we'd rather fight a war we know we're going to lose with honor than to have a revolution at home. And Japan was put in that position too. We gave them a two-headed coin, you know, pull all your troops out of China and let communism overrun China, in which case you'd be facing the Soviet Union plus Communist China, which is what happened, by the way. Communism did overrun China, and that and the Japanese basically didn't send troops into China until Stalin's troops seized Xinjiang, the province of China, and Outer Mongolia. There's a two-headed coin we gave them. Either you pull all your troops back into Japan and die by communism, or die by starvation because we'll strangle you with this economic boycott. And they said, well, if you're given a choice between death and death, we're going to fight. And that's what that ultimatum we gave them just a few days before Pearl Harbor was the trigger that set off the actual attack in Pearl Harbor. We set it off, and it was quite intentional.
Yeah, and just as Wilson campaigned in 1916 on the slogan, he kept us out of war, Roosevelt campaigned in 1940 as he was going to keep us out of the war. My mothers, your sons will not be fighting on any foreign shores. That was a promise he made. But behind the scenes, he was doing everything he can to provoke a war, a backdoor to war, to get the U.S. into the war, to pull, you know, the British, help the British out because they were beleaguered in Europe with Nazi Germany. But looking at the Pacific, why is it the role of the United States to admonish the Japanese and protect European colonial holdings against Japanese aggression? Why would that be a policy of the United States government? You know, the beleaguered empires of the European empires in Asia. You know, why is the United States, who supposedly isn't a colonial power, stepping up, going to bat for these colonial powers? You know, and you know, of course, you know, the seizure of, I think, if you look at it, the seizure of Indonesia and also into French colonial Vietnam, Indochina, as it was called then, was a result of the embargoes and these things. The Japanese thought, you know, well, if we can't trade, we'll seize it, you know.
Right. That was the idea. And part of the idea, too, you know, the embargo was suggested to President Roosevelt on June the 23rd, 1941, by Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes. It's interesting. That was one day after the invasion of the Soviet Union by Germany. And, you know, that invasion, Operation Barbarossa, wasn't just Germany. It was Croatia, Finland, Italy, Hungary, Romania, 47,000 Spanish volunteers, even though Spain remained neutral, and two brigades of volunteers from Belgium. I mean, the purpose of invading the USSR, which I consider the first Rothschild proxy state, I consider Israel the second real proxy state, was to destroy Bolshevism. And Japan, having signed that tripartite treaty with Italy and Germany, there was great fear that Stalin would be caught in a vise between the Axis from Europe on one side and Japan, which had a very powerful military, on the other. But the trade embargo made the prosecution of war impossible because Japan was dependent on foreign oil. And you can't prosecute a war, even drive a car, without oil. Mm-hmm. But there was plenty of oil down in the Dutch East Indies, and this distracted the Japanese and caused them to move south instead of against Stalin and getting him caught in a vise. I do believe that from the deep, deep part of the satanic state, that was really what was going on, the deepest undercurrent. But geopolitically, certainly, they were trying to get into the war and to provoke Japan.
Now, I think we did a show on the true objective of the Korean War, sort of to validate or ratify this idea of a multinational, multilateral military intervention, the subversion of the U.S. Constitution, particularly its parts relating to the Declaration of War, which solely resides in the Congress. But Truman was able to unilaterally start this war by calling a police action and invoking the U.N. And we talked about how this war was dragged out, and you know it was set up the contours of it, or at least the conditions that were made possible for the Korean War, were created during World War II against with our war with Japan, when we allowed Stalin to take half of North Korea. And this factors into your article on the atomic bomb, right?
Actually, it does, thanks to this gentleman, David J. D. Nisi. He wrote an excellent book. I very rarely review books on my website, but his book, Atomic Bomb Secrets, was so outstanding. As I mentioned, he brought out the real reasons for the bombing of Nagasaki, as well as Hiroshima. Hiroshima was the chief center of missionary activity in Japan, but Nagasaki was the center of Christianity in Japan. It was called the Japanese Vatican, again, with 50,000 Christians living there. And it's no coincidence that ground zero for the Fat Man bomb, as they called it, the bomb that was dropped in Nagasaki, it was dropped directly over the largest Christian church in all of the Far East, which is Urakami Cathedral. That was ground zero. That was the point they dropped the bomb, and that is not a coincidence at all. This was an attempt, as Dionisi points out very insightfully, after the war, we forced the Japanese Emperor Hirohito to renounce his divinity, and the satanic powers that be did not want Christianity to move in and fill that void. And they made sure that the centers of Christianity in Japan were obliterated. I should mention, by the way, that the excuse for the atomic bomb given to our public was that we would have had to invade the islands and we would have suffered a million casualties because the Japanese would never surrender. That's not true at all. And this is confirmed by General MacArthur. The Japanese were already offering to surrender, and you know, we demanded unconditional surrender. They said, we will surrender, you can occupy our country, but we want one condition, we want to retain our emperor. And in the end, we granted that one condition anyway. And so the conditions we accepted after dropping the atomic bomb were the exact ones that the Japanese had asked for before the atomic bomb. So the atomic bomb was completely unnecessary, despite propaganda to the contrary.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you could say they dropped it just to test it. And but you write also that, you know, some people have made the claim that it was done to impress Stalin. This was the first, first blow in the Cold War, was the atomic bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And but in your article, you cite the book, I guess, by Jordan's book.
Major George Racy Jordan, right?
Yeah, about how it was arranged, to enable the Soviet Union to acquire the bomb in short order. And this was, he uncovers espionage and some smuggling. And so it really makes no sense if we're dropping the bomb on Japan to impress Stalin, at the same time elements within the U.S. government are working to pass on the secrets and technology so the Soviet Union can develop its own bomb.
To sum all that up, Harry Hopkins, who directed Lend-Lease, has been identified by the Venona tapes released by the FBI as having been a Soviet agent. And he was a top advisor to President Roosevelt. He got to see the decoded Japanese intercepts before Pearl Harbor, which our military commanders in Hawaii did not get to see. But he was like Edward Mandelhouse. He lived right in the White House, no official cabinet position. And he went over to the Soviet Union, met with Stalin, and worked out the details of the Soviet Union occupying North Korea, which is how Kim Il-sung came to power. Quite ridiculous, because the Soviet Union wasn't even involved in the Pacific War. Mm-hmm. They had a non-aggression pact with Japan, and Roosevelt asked, would you break that pact, you know, at the big three conferences, Tehran and Yalta. And Stalin said, yeah, I'll break the pact, provided that America provide my Far Eastern Army with all the materiel, the war supplies and vehicles it needs to fight Japan in Asia. And we did that. We sent 600 shiploads of Lend-Lease to Stalin to fight Japan. And General MacArthur complained about how material that was supposed to go to him went to Russia instead. Well, the Russians waited until 5 days before Japan surrendered to enter the war. We'd already bombed Hiroshima. And then after 5 days participation in the war, they became the rulers of North Korea as a reward for that, and which completely set up the Korean War and set up the Kim family, which is still there today. Really strange how all that came about from American diplomacy. It was really American diplomacy. We were the ones who suggested dividing up Korea into a trusteeship and that Russia should be honored with with the occupation of the North. It really made no sense. But George Racy Jordan was a lend-lease expediter, and he was the one who blew the whistle on Harry Hopkins having provided Stalin with both the blueprints for the atomic bomb, which he discovered in diplomatic suitcases, and he made notes. He had no idea what these various atomic terms he was looking at meant. But he wrote them down. It later turned out they were all related to the atomic bomb. And we also sent Stalin the materials for making his own atomic bomb. But what I learned from Dionysi was that we also gave Stalin Japan's facilities for making an atomic bomb. It turns out the Japanese were working on an atomic bomb of their own. I had not known this previously. But the Japanese were trying to build their own atomic bomb, and they were building it in North Korea because North Korea had a lot of uranium, and it had the chosen dams, which provided a lot of power for the making of atomic bombs. And also, it was far away from Japan itself, so it wouldn't be bombed by American bombers. But that was all part of the factors they're all part of the factors that went into the making of Korea. And that completely fake war, again, as you were saying, Tim, it was designed to strip Congress of its right to declare war. We have not declared had a declaration of war since Korea. Harry Truman sent troops there on his own initiative without so much as consulting the Congress. And it was also to validate the UN, because in 1952, Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council of Foreign Relations, wrote an article called Korea in Perspective. It was their lead article that month. And the author wrote, quote, "The burden of my argument, based on the meaning of our experience in Korea, is that we've made historic progress towards the establishment of a viable system of collective security," end quote, meaning the UN. And, you know, at that time, Tim, now they're trying to build world government from the bottom up. But at that time, they were trying to make the UN from the top down the power that would enforce world security. And that was the one of the main reasons for the Korean War, was to validate the UN. Crazy war.
Yeah, there's this, James Warburg, the scion of the banking family?
Yeah, right.
And the Senate said, we'll have world government, whether either by consent or by force. And, well, it depends what you mean by force or consent, because if you have the influence, the juice to sort of can foment these wars and manipulate the geopolitical, you know, situation around the globe and create these conflicts, whether it be the economic, military, you can maneuver the world into a world government just through fear. And a good example of that is just the existence of the atomic bomb itself, where I think it was H.G. Wells in his book, he wrote how the super weapon, the atomic bomb, would be used to coerce the world into a world government, because of the fear that nation states enjoying sovereignty would get a hold of the bomb and use it against each other. The only way to save the world from nuclear annihilation would be to create a world government, and the atomic bomb itself would be the pretext for that. Which again raises the question: are they, you know, promoting proliferation so they can bring about, you know, international control systems and override national sovereignty? That's the theme in The Shape of Things to Come, in H.G. Wells' book, right?
I didn't actually read that book, but certainly that represents their plan. If you look at the casualties, I believe World War One was about 65 million, World War Two about 85 million. It seems it takes a real huge amount of death and destruction in order to bring about world government. You know, World War One, of course, produced the League of Nations, which failed, and then World War Two brought about the UN. And if they're looking at bringing about a world government, I don't know what they have in mind, but they may, based on experience, think that they have to have a mass casualty event again in order to make and to intimidate people, as you were saying, into accepting world government.
I mean, if you accept the sort of the official narrative, received history of the world wars, World War One, World War Two, the nation state is seen as the you know, progenitor of these things. This is the problem. We have these nation states, and you have build armies, and they fight. So we have to do away with sovereignty, do away with borders, and we all become one. We need a world government. When if you read the esoteric or occulted history of these wars, it is these transnational cosmopolitan figures that are bypassing the nation states, that transcend nation states, that work together. These banking families that are based in Frankfurt or in Paris and London and New York, that are organizing these things and making, at the time, of course, in the process, making a fortune, fomenting these wars. And it isn't the nation state. The nation states are simply, they're set up for this. And they get the respective so-called sovereign states are taken over, infiltrated by agents of these things. It's very Freemasonic, if you ask me.
Right, it's all international, and Freemasonry is international. Yeah. You know, it involves loyalty to the brotherhood that even takes precedence over your loyalty to your own country, at least if you're at the upper satanic levels of Freemasonry, and certainly not the Blue Lodge level. They would still enlist.
Yeah, I mean, during World War II, an example of this is the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is its own sovereign entity. it was... The Bank of London was making payments to the Reichsbank, and vice versa, during World War II. And people commented how these various bankers, Helmut Schacht, not Benjamin Strong, but who was the guy, the head of the London of the British Central Bank,
Norman Montague.
Norman Montague was good friends with Benjamin Strong, and Benjamin Strong was good friends with Norman Montague, and they all were friends with Helmut Schacht, the German head of the German Reichsbank. And during World War II, they would meet, and these things. Or Benjamin Strong, long since dead, but Norman Montague, I think, lived in 1944. But the point being is, these bankers, some people commented out during the peak of the war, 1943-44, the various bankers would meet from Germany and from London and from France and America, and they would act as if the war wasn't even going on. They were just conducting business.
Yeah, Tim, tell me, what do you think is the most reliable book on that, about Schlacht and Montague and meeting during World War II? I need to, people have written to me about that. I need to look a little more deeply at that.
Well, there's a lot of detail in Carol Quigley's book about this.
Oh, okay. All right. Read parts of Quigley. You know, Quigley's book, I have to admit, I've never gotten all the way through it.
Most people haven't.
I started to fall asleep after about 400 pages. I didn't get that far in it, but I do have it, and I'll check that out.
But he talks in detail about about this Anglo-American system. And a while back, I did interviews with Jay Dyer, who actually did go through the book and examine these things. And in some of his lectures, he goes into detail about the connections and the dealings between the Bank of England and the Bank of International Settlements, which is established after World War One to process the payments from Germany, the reparation payments. But even after the reparation regime collapsed, when Hitler repudiated it, the Bank of International Settlements, as you all know, still exists. And that's how you make sense of all these dealings with the Bushes and the Union Bank and Fritz Thyssen and these things. And people will kind of say, well, Bush was a Nazi or had Nazi sympathies and these things, which probably isn't the case. What happened? These figures have these, they represent these transnational financial interests, the ruling elite, the Illuminati, the elite, whatever you want to call them. And these business connections are not going to be cut off because of a war. In fact, they're going to be, there are opportunities to make even more money and to reorganize, the world in a way that's more profitable, and they can get more control, and they can, use these wars to sort of change the geography of production around the world. That's what the CFR, the Trilateral Commission, is all about. And the process of reorganizing the geography of production requires fomenting and creating civil wars, supporting people like Mao and spreading communism and these things. So decades later, they can turn China into a factory house for the, you know, for the West, while at the same time the United States is deindustrializing.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing how long-term the plan is. And if you understand it from a satanic viewpoint, it becomes sensible long-term. If you try to understand it as just bankers trying to make immediate profits for themselves, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But there really is a long-term plan unfolding. And speaking of wars and how meetings take place that are that transcend the national conflicts, during the American Revolution, you had private correspondence taking place between William Howe, the British commander for a number of years, and Ben Franklin, high-ranking Freemason, and George Washington, all Freemasons. And General Howe was eventually dismissed by King George III, but he used to be toasted by the American troops because he let the Americans, you know, win a number of key battles, and his descendants burned his correspondence. These are people who are corresponding in the course of a war in contravention of their own national interests, but because they have a higher loyalty to an international organization, in this particular case, in reference to the Revolutionary War being Freemasonry.
Yeah. And of course, that Freemasonry, of course, would play a pivotal role in fomenting the French Revolution a decade later. Yeah.
And the subsequent European revolutions, the Portuguese Revolution of 1910, the Mazzini Revolutions, the Young Turk Revolution in Turkey. You always see the hand of Freemasonry. And you mentioned before in Bolivia, Simon Bolivar and the South American revolutions. You always see the hand of Freemasonry in revolutions. It seems like they are the ground troops, sworn to secrecy, sworn to loyalty, and receiving minor or moderate or major material rewards, depending for their service to the International Brotherhood.
Yeah, and it seems so if you're a member, a high enough member, you can flash a certain hand sign and get out of trouble. That's what apparently happened with Santa Anna after he lost to Sam Houston. He was going to be shot, then he flashed a Freemasonic hand sign, and he was let go, and he went on to live and prosper in the United States.
Okay, that's the first I heard of him flashing that sign. Okay. Nothing surprising. And as one unravels history, Tim.
Mm-hmm. None of these, even the so-called American Civil War, it isn't simply just the North against the South and the issue of secession, or is it slavery, or is it the tariff? Behind that also is a plan to to bring about some sort of destruction out of chaos, order, and out of the dialectic, get a new situation. What you got in the United States was a completely centralized state with no real opposition to its ambitions, which again would be an objective of Freemasonry.
Right, the 10th Amendment basically being nullified. Mm-hmm. And just to validate what you're saying about Freemasonry, of course, South Carolina was the center of Freemasonry, mm-hmm. and that was the first state to secede, and that's certainly no coincidence.
Mm-hmm. It's about controlled opposition, dialectics, and it, mm-hmm. it complicates things because we like to read history as sort of a good versus bad, evil, and black versus white. And, you know, it's that Freemasonic chessboard, right? But it's a bit more complicated than that.
Very much so.
Now, okay, that's interesting because you write about, of course, Harry Truman and the Nakba. Apparently, his recognition of the State of Israel wasn't just Harry's sentimental nature coming through. He was, I guess he was bribed?
according to a story told by Gore Vidal, Vidal said he was told by John F. Kennedy that the reason that Israel was recognized so quickly, and when we talk about quick, we're talking about 11 minutes. 11 minutes after the State of Israel was proclaimed in 1948, Harry Truman recognized it. Mm-hmm. Now, 11 minutes, that's not a normal diplomatic process. According to John F. Kennedy, he'd been bribed with $2 million in a suitcase. And according to Tex Mars, the FBI reports indicate that that man who had given that bribe was Abraham Feinberg, the founder of AIPAC, which would not be surprising either.
Some things never change.
Yeah. But that particular chapter, chapter 7 of my book, is called 1948, Harry Truman, the Nakba, and the Mystery of the Great of the Best Picture Oscar. And there's a kind of an interesting story about that. In the late 60s, when I was a teenager, my father and I were watching television, and the local station said, you know, this coming Friday, we're going to be showing the winner of the Best Picture Oscar for 1947, Gentleman's Agreement. My father and I thought, wow, this is going to be a great movie, right? Because we thought of Best Picture meant something like Bridge on the River Kwai or Lawrence of Arabia, All About Eve. Something was really going to be good entertainment. So we were waiting this film with great anticipation. And in the entire film, we were stunned. It was a very boring, long sermon on the woe of American anti-Semitism. And you have to understand that my father was Jewish. I'm half Jewish myself. So it wasn't like we had anything against the message of this movie. But it was just so boring. I mean, it was all dialogue. And in that dialogue, there was no humor. There was no action. And they just tacked on a romance between Gregory Peck and Dorothy McGuire for the sake of having a romance. And the basic plot is that Gregory Peck is a magazine writer, and he's assigned by his editor to write a series on anti-Semitism. And so he decides to pretend that he's Jewish. And throughout the film, he encounters anti-Semitism from everybody, from his girlfriend, from his secretary, from his janitor, from his doctor. And it's always very subtle, but the whole movie is him encountering anti-Semitism, and he scolds the people for their anti-Semitism. And that's basically the movie. And we kept waiting, my father and me, for the movie to get interested. We started to have him make jokes to keep awake watching this movie. And again, it wasn't the message that we were against. Nothing wrong with the message against bigotry. But the film was so boring, and it just was not something that you considered from an entertainment perspective worthy of best Oscar. Well, that was a mystery to us. And we said, why did this movie get the best picture Oscar? And then it's no longer a mystery to me now, because I've looked at history, and that Oscar was awarded on March the 20th, 1948. And on May the 11th, 1948, Israel was proclaimed a state. And 11 minutes later, Harry Truman recognized it. And the reason it got that Oscar, Tim, was that they wanted to squelch any criticism of that decision. And the message of that movie was that any criticism of Israel, not Israel, but Zionism or Judaism, no matter how subtle it is, must be stamped out. That was the basic message of that movie. And that's why it won that Oscar, was to dignify that message. And so that Oscar, after, you know, 40-some years, is no longer a mystery to me. And now I know it was given for completely geopolitical reasons. But I also contrasted in this chapter, the Nakba took place in 1948 as well. And that's when 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. Well, they were forcibly removed from their homes. There were more than 30 massacres of Arabs by the Zionists. They were driven from their homes. That was the real tragedy of 1948, not Gregory Peck failing to get the best room in a hotel because he had a Jewish name. That was not the tragedy in 1948. But that's what the American public was led to believe, who never even heard of the Nakba until recently, when social media has brought it to people's attention.
Yeah, they control the media by Jewish interests. Obviously control the narrative of these things. You don't even hear about these things. So, and also because of the World War II narrative, people were particularly sensitive because of the, you know, alleged Holocaust. So any criticism of Jewish, inordinate Jewish influence or power or policies favoring Jewish interest, Zionist interest, you can just, you know, we see this today. Just, well, you're an anti-Semite. We have Florida passing a law making it illegal to express anti-Semitic, beliefs or sentiments in school. Now, of course, they don't define what anti-Semitism is. To them, anti-Semitism is criticizing Jewish organizations or Jewish individuals, which is absurd.
Right.
If Gentleman's Agreement, they had Gregory Peck, if he wanted to, going undercover as a Jew, posing as a Jew, did he, like, behave obnoxiously? Did he screw people over?
Oh, no. He was behaving as honorably as possible.
Yeah, see, there's the thing. It's
acting as a true Christian.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, again, this is the exception that anti-Semitism or ill will or tension between a Christian or you know, and Jews is always because Christians are just irrationally hateful and anti-Semitic, as opposed to responding to certain types of behavior or being provoked in these things. But it's interesting. They make this movie. It's this key moment. It just shows how, again, how you wouldn't think that, you know, what's coming at, what's being provided as an entertainment fair has anything to do, any coordination with those designing policy. But it is, which goes to show the how things are controlled, how the political process and culture is manipulated, and there's a high level of coordination going on there.
Well, Tim, I'm sure you remember the last show we actually did was about It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. and we talked about why it did not win the Best Picture Oscar, mm-hmm. and even James Stewart did not win the Best Picture Oscar. Instead, it went to a very politically correct movie called The Best Years of Our Lives, and the mm-hmm. Best Actor Oscar went to a guy, Frederick March, who had really just a party walkthrough with very little effort, playing a banker who was advocating GIs taking out loans mm-hmm. instead of yeah. James Stewart, and went to Wonderful Life. So that was 1946, the Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Picture of 1946, and now we're talking about the Best Picture of 1947. So you see how active a role politics have played in the selection of Oscars. Not always. I think there have been some very good movies that deservedly won Best Picture. I think Lawrence of Arabia would be a great example of it. That was a well-done movie, and it deserved the Oscar that it got. But a lot of Oscars, unfortunately.
Some propaganda movies that are particularly artful. They are good.
Right.
You know,
so right. Even Lawrence of Arabia had some propaganda mixed in, but it was an entertaining movie.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you look at something like the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, mm-hmm. Gregory Peck, which is a much better movie, but the script is great. The movie adaptation, I've never read the book, actually. But look at that movie, how it's hard to take issue with, at least how that story is told. Mm-hmm. But you can see how that would play into the civil rights revolution of the 1960s, and how that that movement was co-opted and used for other objectives, using, you know, civil rights movement as a proxy force to destroy what remained of constitutional government, and also to justify the sort of this movement towards integration and the destruction of ethnic enclaves or neighborhoods, and creating of sort of this suburbia. You know, and you have to see how this, basically to instill a feeling of guilt. So,
right.
Yeah.
You know, Tim, I'd not thought about that before, but that won Best Picture of 1963. And on the heels of that, you had the forced busing and the civil rights legislation. Yeah. I'd never thought about that.
Yeah. So how do you oppose forced busing when you're watching great? Because it's a great movie. I love the movie. My kids watch it. It's a great movie.
Right. I had not thought about that. But once again, you see the sleight of hand being played by Hollywood in mm-hmm. Pushing people to accept certain agendas.
Look at The Pawnbroker with Rod Steiger, and that broke the production code.
Oh, yes. We've talked about that before. It was the first Hollywood movie that showed naked female breasts, but it was mm-hmm. also about a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. So if you criticize that movie, you're an anti-Semite. And now they've broken that taboo. And from then on, naked female breasts could be shown in Hollywood movies. So
that and more.
It's a word. I'm sorry.
Now it's on your computer screen.
Oh, sure. Hopefully anyway, not ours. Yeah.
Everyone's iPhone smartphone if they want it, and even if they don't want it, probably. Now, I get things sent to me. I'm like, I didn't ever ask for this stuff.
Which, right.
But yeah, that's just how these movies are. You know, even though they pull on our heartstrings, they manipulate our better nature, which is so frustrating about this. And you have to look at the sub rosa, the esoteric meaning of these events, almost universally praised as the civil rights movement, these things can be easily weaponized, and they have been weaponized. You wouldn't have the demographics in the country today, not just racial, but also where people live, if you didn't have that social engineering going along with forced integration and busing and creation of suburbia and these things to create sort of the deracinated, guilt-ridden white supermajority of the United mm-hmm. States, which can now be subjected to all types of psychological warfare and and apparently put on the chopping block as, you know, as the elite savor the Browning of America, whatever that means.
Right. You know? You're right. As we look at the implementation of what they call the Kalergi Plan in Europe, mm-hmm. with the mass migration there and the destruction of European civilization, the long-term plan starts to make sense, and you see how these events of the 1960s played into that. But it takes some perspective to put it all together.
Yeah, and you'll see that you have to do the reading. I mean, you have to find out what, you know where the bodies are buried, know who did what and when and how mm-hmm. they did it, and that takes, you know, reading a lot of books, and you're not going to get this on, you know, on the CBS Evening News or you're not going to hear it on All Things Considered on National Public Radio or anything.
Something's considered. That's why people need to be out of the matrix and listening to alt media with discernment. Because
And most in the alt media have to... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, as long as you're in the matrix, you're never going to know the truth. I mean, you're just going to keep riding down that river further and further away into delusion.
And those in the alternative media have to realize that they themselves have been test subjects in this social engineering and psychological warfare operation that's been going on for decades. And you'll see it now how a lot of, you know, the development of white identity itself is a reaction, because that white identity, again, is a negative identity in contrast to, to this agenda. And but you know, again, you see a lot of these groups now, you know, the rise of neo-paganism and these things, and there's sort of the the hatred they have towards Christianity or Catholicism in particular. But the problem is it's because many of these people have lost their identity because they've lost their faith, and now they're easier targets, and now they're trying to cling to something like whiteness as an identity. Which, in a certain level, it does exist, because we hear about white guilt or, you know, white privilege. So if white privilege does exist, then at least they're acknowledging it at some level. But really, it's whiteness itself is a product of deracination, at least in the United States. You know, unless you're thinking like you're talking about European heritage and European these things, you know. But It's difficult because, again, most people want to go after the immediate enemy, as opposed to focusing on, you know, who's pulling the strings or who's, you know, controlling the puppets.
Well, I'm sure that you're correct in that alt media has been manipulated to a certain extent, and I think that again, I've never been Catholic, but I think that I see within alt media a lot of attacks, ridicule of the Catholic Church, not understanding the history, not understanding the infiltration mm-hmm. that has taken place, the historic opposition of Freemasonry, which has been, you know, played such a great role in the New World Order in opposing the Catholic Church, and it's the gradual degradation of Catholicism over the years. And a lot of people in alt media have fallen into that trap, and there are a number of traps, and I'm probably in some that I myself don't even know about. But, you know, we try to raise our head above these and to, you know, look objectively at them, fact based.
There's decades of cultural degradation that precedes the demographic warfare that's being waged now, because you have to demoralize, the population in order to reduce it eventually. And this has largely been done through the sexual revolution, sexual freedom, mm-hmm. In the West and, you know, here in the United States, but also in Europe, particularly Germany after World War II, when, along with the currency reforms and after 1949, they started pumping in tons and tons of pornography and producing films, that would, eventually leaves sort of the demoralized, morally corrupted post-war, generation in Europe, which would lead to lower birth rates, family breakup, mm-hmm. which then creates the vacuum that that migrants fill.
And that's what they were doing in the Weimar Republic mm-hmm. after World War I. As well was the sexual degradation in, mm-hmm. in Germany. And they tried to introduce that in Spain when the communists took over as well. So that definitely has been a factor. And there's definitely, you know, a satanic intelligence to that. It goes beyond, you know, the mindset of a street level communist to understand that pornography is going to help destroy the society. You know, there's definitely a higher intelligence there, but of a very wicked nature.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, why is pornography essentially free now? I mean, it's
to destroy human character. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Here's an interesting chapter. You have Making Sense of the Supernatural, Aliens, UFOs, Fallen Angels, Nephilim, The Flood, The Bible, Transhumanism, and the Illuminati. Yes, they all tie together. Okay.
Okay, well, you know, Tim, this is actually a subject. The whole thing of UFOs and aliens was never one that I cared for. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been a ufologist, and I've never really studied that stuff. And, you know, for a long time, I thought that UFOs were probably sort of a, you know, some sort of a black budget funded Pentagon psyop. Because, you know, back in the 60s, there was this report from Iron Mountain, mm-hmm. it was a leaked tank study, and they talked about ways of controlling the population. And one way was to fake an alien invasion, you know, get the world countries to unite into a world government because they thought that the aliens were afoot, right? But they said at that time in the 60s they didn't have the technology for it. Then you saw in the 70s they started to make movies, high budget movies about aliens, you know, E.T. and Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and they've continued to make them. And you had Serge Manasse discussing Project Bluebeam, which I think there's a lot of reality to. And I do think there is a lot of PSYOP involved here. And you've had Reagan and Clinton, President Clinton, talking about how an alien invasion would unite mankind. So for a long time, I just thought, you know, this is just a Pentagon PSYOP. But then I was talking to a friend who's a 9/11 truther, and she said, have you ever read the works of L.A. Marzulli? And I said, I haven't. I started reading his works. He's a Christian gentleman who studies UFOs. Has everybody on your show?
No.
Okay. He studies UFOs, giants, things of that nature, and very honorable man. And I had a friend who is a Christian and Air Force veteran, and he told our Bible study one night that during a bombing mission in Vietnam that they had a UFO right alongside them. It was right on their radar, and it just took off at like thousands of miles per hour. And so I started looking at this and said, there's more to this than just a PSYOP going on. And one of the things that started to intrigue me was the history of the flood, the biblical flood. And, you know, I've written two books on creation versus evolution back in the late 90s, early 2000s, Case Against Darwin and Tornado in a Junkyard. And there's a lot of evidence that the flood took place. I mean, physical evidence, the fact that 75% of all rock is sedimentary, and the fact that you have all these billions of fossils. Well, you know, to create a fossil, you have to be buried by sediments very fast. I mean, we almost never see a fossil get created these days. And so I knew that the flood took place, and not only that from the physical evidence, but the fact that there's more than 200 cultures around the world, you know, from the Aleutians to the American Indians that have flood legends, you know, the earth being covered by a flood. So it happened. And if you go into Genesis 6, it talks about how it says when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. They took wives of which all they chose. There were giants in the earth in those days. And after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. And there's always been controversy. But then, following the lead of Marzulli, I started to look at the extra-canonical books of Enoch, Jasher, and Jubilees, which absolutely confirmed that these were angels mating with women and creating a race of giants. And this is validated by all the accounts that were published, to this day, really, but especially in the last couple of centuries, about the discovery of giants entombed in the earth, which many of which were sent to Smithsonian and quickly destroyed. I think destroyed for a couple of reasons. One is that they counteracted Darwin's argument that we came from smaller creatures, And also, they validated the biblical account. You know, the giants are in the Bible. There's Goliath and several examples of the Bible. Of course, the Hebrews coming out of Egypt encountered giants in the land of Canaan. And not to say they wanted to discredit the Bible. It's a big part of the whole satanic agenda. But I realized that what we're seeing today happen in the world is very similar to what was happening prior to the flood. Because today we have all this transhumanism, right? We've got transgenderism, of course, but we've got scientists who are experimenting with putting human genes, mixing human genes with animal genes. And if you start to look at these extra-biblical books, if you read, for example, the book of Jasher, chapter 4, verse 18, it says, quote, "The sons of men in those days took the cattle of the earth, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the earth, and taught the mixture of animals of one species with another in order to provoke the Lord. And God saw the whole earth, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon the earth, all men and all animals." And it says in the book of Jubilees, chapter 5, "It came to pass when the children of men began to multiply on the face of the earth and the daughters were born to them that the angels of God took the certain year of this Jubilee, that they were beautiful to look upon, took themselves wives of all whom they chose, and they bare them unto sons, and they were giants. And it says, all flesh corrupted its way, all alike, men and cattle and beasts and birds of, and everything that walketh on the earth. All of them corrupted their ways and their orders." And quote. That's Jubilees 5, 1 to 2. So I looked at this, Tim, and Jubilees and Jasher, by the way, are mentioned in the Bible. The book of Enoch is quoted in the Bible, so they're not canonical, but they're at least given some validation by the Bible. And I realized that what we're doing today with transgenderism and transhumanism and this this CERN project that they say is opening a portal to the, you know, the dark outer forces, that we're calling back these fallen angels. And we're starting to do the same things that were happening before the flood, that were starting to actually, if you look at alien abduction stories, which it seems that there are credible people who have experienced these things, they often involve some kind of sexual experimentation, trying to the aliens or the, which I believe really fallen angels, trying to mix. And I believe that if the fallen angels return during a period of the Antichrist, that what they're going to do is they're going to tell humanity, and this has been built up for us through all these alien movies, all the, you know, the Men in Black and Alien and Star Wars and all these movies that have normalized the idea of these alien civilizations. When the fallen angels come again, I believe they'll come again a second time, they will tell men that we're from an advanced civilization from another galaxy, and this will be normalized for us. But what they'll do, of course, is they're going to bring evil upon the earth as they did before. But everything is pointing to this way, for me, Tim, is pointing this way, the transhumanism, the mixing of species. It's very possible that when you look back at Greek mythology, for example, they talked about Hercules being the offspring of a celestial being and a woman. I believe that's a reference to the Nephilim, the which the Bible talks about, the giants who were being brought about by this mixture of angels and humans. And if you look at the Greek mythology of this creature called the centaur, which was a half, part human and part horse. Well, look at the way they're mixing species today. I believe we're doing the same thing. So this chapter is sort of a validation of the Bible, a validation of the extra-biblical accounts, and looking with some concern that mankind, with its GMOs and its experimentation with genes and changing of the way God created things, that we're headed into the same fields of endeavor that led to the original destruction of the earth through the flood. And you know, a lot of people think that God was just being a generous, you know, people like Richard Dawkins would say that God was just this genocidal maniac, and he murdered mankind with a flood. Actually, the way I look on it is that he had to reboot the planet. This whole corruption was, his whole creation was being corrupted, and that's the exact path we're headed down now. And that's basically what this chapter concerns.
Yeah, basically the flood was precipitated by the corruption of man, and mm-hmm. the earth had to be washed clean.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe that exactly what happened. Yeah.
And now we're seeing again, as you say, with this transhumanism, transgenderism, insanity, and these things, and the notion that you can experiment and you can change your sex by mutilating yourself or by taking hormones, and or just with GMOs and what they're doing with crops like Terminator seeds and things like that.
Yeah, how long will God, you know, permit this to happen? He obviously reached a breaking point before the flood, and I believe that a breaking point will come again, but apparently we will get a visitation of some kind from these fallen angels and perhaps some return of the Nephilim, perhaps that's what these superhero movies are about. And, of course, the Bible speaks of the man of lawlessness, the beast, the one who will rule from this rebuilt temple in Jerusalem for, unfortunately, a limited amount of time, limited number of years.
And they're looking to rebuild, at least build the third temple now, right?
Right, which unfortunately I have a chapter on Christian Zionism, which you and I have done a show on, but the whole Christian Zionist movement has bought into this, that we have to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, despite Jesus simply prophesying that it would be torn down. And they say that Jesus will rule from this temple, when Jesus always rejected being an earthly ruler. And he said not to believe anyone if you believe that Jesus is in the out in the desert or in the inner rooms, right? He warned people not to believe that, but Christian Zionists are believing it. He's going to come back and rule, and who they accept as the return of Christ, I believe, is going to be actually this satanic figure, this man of lawlessness, this beast, who will rule according to the book of Revelation, for a very limited number of years before God finally intervenes. But that's kind of where I believe we're headed with the alien movies and the talk of aliens and UFOs and future civilizations and Christian Zionism.
Yeah. And of course, and you see what's going on around you with more or less legalized infanticide in New York, although there's some pushback in Alabama, from what I understand.
Isn't that great? They're actually introduced a bill. I applaud Alabama. They say they're going to criminalize abortion, in contrast to New York, which was applauding and celebrating full-term abortion. I'm glad to know that there are people down south who still retain integrity and morality, and are out of that satanic matrix of belief.
Yeah, I'm sure the Supreme Court will, or at least the federal courts will, strike it down as unconstitutional because of the Roe v. Wade decision. But it's either way, it's worth the effort to send a message out there, you know, that's a positive sign, signs of life, I guess you could say, positive signs. But this is why maybe you look around today and you have, you have transvestites reading storybooks to children in public libraries.
It's insane. It's criminal. It's stuff that people would not have countenanced a few years ago. But I think that it has a lot to do with the dumbing down of America. I guess, you could say beginning with television, but then, all the electronic devices, the electromagnetic radiation, the fluoridation of the water, the GMOs, genetically altered foods people are eating, and just the constant stream of propaganda flowing from
mainstream. Oh, yeah. I was out and about today, and a school bus stopped in front of me to let the students disembark, and I watched maybe a dozen, 20 kids get off the bus. All of them had earphones in their ears, and they're all staring into their phone as they walk down the street.
Yeah, I've got a chapter in this book. Again, it's called 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, which, by the way, if people don't want to buy the book, they can find these written as blog posts, either on my blog or for other people's blogs, because I don't want people to pay for something that they felt they should have gotten for free. But I felt with all the websites and people being taken down from social media that I should put some of my more important work into hard copy. But I do have an interview, it's chapter 12, with Cece Doucette, who is the greatest wireless educator in my state, Massachusetts. We talk about Wi-Fi, we talk about 5G, we talk about smart meters, what you can do to protect your home and your children. And there's no question, Tim, that Wi-Fi has been responsible for a great many illnesses. It's been proven scientifically. It contributes to cancer, to heart irregularities, to lowered sperm counts, which we're seeing nationally, to altered DNA, and now they want 5G to come in, mm-hmm. where they're going to put a cell phone tower not a mile from your home, but right outside your window, and it's going to be 25 times stronger than the current Wi-Fi, and it's pretty frightening. And then there's very serious about it, and the battle is on now. I believe this is a big part of the end game for them to reach a point. I believe if Satan, you know, how at the end of Orwell's 1984, Winston was so brainwashed that he just looked at the image of Big Brother and said, I love Big Brother. And I think mm-hmm. that they want to reach a point where they can actually control people's thoughts through electromagnetic waves, the way that Serge Manasse predicted would happen when he talked about Project Blue Beam in 1994. That they're actually going to try and control our thinking. And at that point, there could be no rebellion against this new world order. And I believe that's probably the point at which God would say, that's enough, throw down the gauntlet and no more yeah. To my creation. But 5G is certainly one of the worst things. But since we're probably going to wrap up soon, let me just mention the rest of this book, which again is a companion book to my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. In addition to the Spanish-American War, Pearl Harbor, Lusitania, Hindenburg, Nagasaki, the Nakba, we also have chapters and aliens and this interview with CC Doucette on wireless. We also have chapters on the Golden Age of Television, which you and I did a show on, Christian Zionism, what's really happening in the war in Syria. And finally, what is pretty interesting for me, because I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, who fired the shot heard around the world in 1775. That might sound insignificant, but that shot began the American Revolution, which generated America, which in turn has influenced the whole world around us. And my conclusion, growing up in Lexington and having studied it from the viewpoint of a veteran alt-meter writer 34 years now, is that the events of Lexington April the 19th, 1775, what we call Patriot's Day, was a Freemasonic event, very carefully orchestrated, which is one reason why the Freemasons have their headquarters for their entire northern jurisdiction today in the town of Lexington, Massachusetts.
And you could say it's the reason why Washington, D.C. is, well, you could say it's one big Masonic temple.
Oh, yeah. The whole architecture. Yeah. You know, Chris Pinto, have you seen his videos? On the secret beginnings of America. There's about four of them on YouTube, and he has one that's entirely dedicated to the Freemasonic architecture of Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. Chris Pinto, that's P-I-N-T-O. Some really good he's not very sympathetic to Catholicism, I have to say. You know, he's very evangelical in his outlook. But yeah. He has some really good stuff on the beginnings of America. In fact, he has one that was kind of a wake-up call for me. It's called The Hidden Faith of the Founding Fathers, and he talks about Thomas Paine. You and I think, did a show on Thomas Paine, the real author of the Declaration of Independence. It was bitterly anti-Christian. It was not Thomas Jefferson who wrote the Declaration at all. Jefferson didn't take credit until 45 years after the fact, after Paine was dead. But America, sad to say, while many people think of it as having begun as a Christian nation, and to a certain extent, that certainly is true, no question about it. But certainly the American Revolution was a Freemasonic event that was really a part of the whole chronology of Freemasonic revolutions around the world and intended to create this new world order we see unfolding before us. Tim?
Yeah, you here?
I'm sorry.
I had some trouble with my earphones. I'm sorry. So I had to quickly unplug them. So, here. So the book, 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, Solving Political, Culture, and Spiritual Riddles, Past and Present. Where's the best place to get it?
Well, you know, you can read about it on my website, jamesperloff.com, but I recommend that people buy through Amazon. Because it's hard for me to pack up individual orders for the book. Would be very time consuming. I don't like Amazon. I don't like the way Jeff Bezos is, I think, very deliberately trying to wipe out independent retailers. But right now, for me, I do appreciate the convenience of having Amazon take care of the billing and shipping.
Yeah.
Individual books. It enables me to carry on my more significant work than the shipping itself. So Amazon is the best place to buy the book.
Okay, great. So Amazon, of course, James Perloff, jamesperloff.com.
Yes, and the book, again, is 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw, going into the material we talked about tonight. Again, a companion book to Truth as a Lonely Warrior, a basic primer on the New World Order, its whole history.
Okay, great. Listen, James, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Tim. What a delight to talk to you. And, you know, I have to say that I probably learned more from you than any other host that I'm on with. There's always something new I learn about history from you.
That's good. Well, yeah, yeah. We give and take, right? Give and take.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a very edifying one.
So, okay, listen. Good night, Dan. I'll post this soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay, fantastic. When do you think it might post?
Oh, probably tomorrow afternoon sometime.
Oh, that's soon. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Okay, great.
Okay, great.
I'll notify my followers on Twitter if I haven't lost them by tomorrow. and I'll put it on my website.
Great. Okay, good night then.
Okay, good night.
Take it easy. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.